We good to go?
Okay.
Okay, perfect, thank you. Sabine Jafar's novel, Fakhriya, was written in Russian and then translated by Javed Abbasov to Azeri, focuses on one Azeri woman's experience during the Karabakh War, which took place from late 1980s to 1944. The Karabakh War was an ethnic and territorial conflict in the enclave of Nagorno-Karabakh in southwestern Azerbaijan between the majority ethnic Armenians and Nagorno-Karabakh backed by Armenia and the Republic of Azerbaijan. Following Armenians and Azeris, following the conflict, initially peaceful demands to unify this region with Armenia in 1988, the conflict between Armenians and Azeris turned increasingly violent as the USSR collapsed, resulting in ethnic cleansing of Azeris and a subsequent retaliation from Azerbaijan towards the Armenian population. The novel focuses on one aspect of the Karabakh War, the dreadful viciousness demonstrated by the Armenian troops. During the Karabakh War, Armenian troops demonstrated horrific brutality, especially towards women whom they brutally and sometimes publicly sexually assaulted. Jafar explores the historical circumstance through the memories of her title character, Fakhriya, who reveals the woman's forced silence of their experience during the war between Armenia and Azerbaijan and the atrocities of sexual violence that they faced. The context for Fakhriya's narration consists of an incidental and temporary community of female listeners created by the fact that Fakhriya shares a hospital room with two other women, Mila and Sevinç, a character whose name matches the author's. In this sense, Jafar creates a metafictional structure for the novel in which author-narrator Sevinç controls the novel's framed story while she in turn listens to Fakhriya narrate her experiences during the Karabakh War. In the novel, Fakhriya's flashback, her story during the Karabakh War, occurs when she's 19 years old and must escape her village in Azerbaijan due to the attack to the Armenian troops. Her family's Armenian neighbors protect her by hiding her in their basement and later send her to run away to Baku. On the way, Fakhriya sees an Armenian woman in the middle of childbirth. She saves the newborn child, names him Amir, and raises him as her own. Fakhriya's flashback ends in Moscow, outside a restaurant where Fakhriya, her husband Murat, whose name means desire in Azeri, and Amir dine. On their way out, a man approaches them and asks, quote unquote, "I apologize, tell me please, is your name Fakhriya?" The man, Armen, was from Fakhriya's past. After a quick chat, Armen asks Fakhriya whether the boy is her son, to which she positively replies. Armen notes that, quote unquote, he, Amir, resembles his friend, Fakhriya's deceased brother, Amir. Fakhriya's family and Armen part ways, which ends the flashback. This statement that Fakhriya's adopted Armenian son resembles her Azeri brother adds an element of reconciliation in this meeting, which reveals Jafar's hope and desire, as Murad's name suggests, for a metaphorical reconciliation between the Azeri and Armenian nations. The novel concludes with Fakhriya, Mila, and Sevinç leaving the hospital on the same day. Jafar's Fakhriya demonstrates how Azeri women ironically use the oppressive power structures of Soviet colonization, including and especially the Russian language, to gain symbolic power for themselves. By drawing a parallel between the power structures of Soviet rule over Azerbaijan and male dominance over females in pre-Soviet Azerbaijan, I'll demonstrate how the discourse of modernity under the Soviet Empire enabled Azeri women to overcome traditional gender roles. Thus, Soviet colonization enabled Azeri women to gain agency within a hegemonically masculine society by obtaining education and employment through the changes in power structures under Soviet rule. As Kenneth Zirker writes in his article, The Linguistic Constructions of Gender in Azerbaijan, women in Azerbaijan use the Russian language to distance themselves from the traditional gender roles associated with the Azeri language. Zirker explains that Azeri women use Russian because it gives them an advantage in job opportunities, prestige, and cultural values. Although Zirker's research explores the sociolinguistic context of daily speech interaction, I posit that Azeri Russophone literature also allows a space for interrogating both hegemonic masculinity and the oppression of women during and after Soviet rule. In my thesis, I'll argue that despite the cultural hegemony under Russian colonialism, women in Azerbaijan use the discourse of colonial modernity to transcend traditional gender roles. I'll explore the ways in which colonial language politics implicitly inform constructions of gender in Soviet and independent Azerbaijan, Indeed, the fact that Jafar's work was written in Russian suggests that it remains the language of modernity in Azerbaijan. That is, the Russian linguistic and cultural space paradoxically enables feminine discourse for Azeri women, even while subordinating Azeri culture and people within oppressive colonial structures. As I will show, Jafar uses Russian to express women's experiences of sexual violence during the Karabakh War beyond the gender roles that dictate the limits of appropriate speech in Azeri. Jafar also uses fictionalized testimony to voice Azeri women's silence surrounding their experiences of sexual violence during the Karabakh conflict. Jafar's metafictional gestures allude to the celebrated work of Belarusian author Svetlana Alexievich, whose oral histories of Soviet women's experiences during World War II won her the Nobel Prize in 2015. In contrast to these testimonies, however, Jafar's novel reminds us that although the text offers testimony, fictional representation can offer a version of events and a vision of the future beyond limitations of the genres of oral history or testimony. Bahia's fictitious genre, unlike historical testimonies, enables her to present a realist version of events that nevertheless extends beyond the strict representations of reality. Azerbaijan officially gained its independence for the first time on October 18, 1991, just 2 months before the collapse of the USSR. Azerbaijan was part of the Soviet Union for about 70 years, and consequently, the Russian language, the lingua franca of the Soviet state, affected Azeri literature, which became Azeri Russophone literature. We can see that the Soviet Union's use of colonial discourse, in the sense that they used, as Dipesh Chakraborty describes in the context of India, the notion of not yet, to extend their colonial rule by suggesting that Azeris are not yet capable of governing themselves. The Soviet Union also implemented Russian throughout Azerbaijan and integrated it into the school curriculum to force Azeri people to speak it. In his article analyzing literary representations of the Karabakh War, Mikhail Mamedov notes that despite the stated Soviet goal of creating unity amongst nations, quote unquote, Russians and Armenians controlled all high positions in the city and were in higher social positions relative to the native population of the Republic. Indeed, continuing this tradition of the post-colonial context, Sevin Jafar's 2018 novel uses Russian to voice the previously silenced experiences of women during the Karabakh War. Zirka's article further helps us understand Jafar's use of Russian to write her novel. Zirka mentions that in Azerbaijan, the Russian language holds more prestige than Azeri. However, with time, the prestige of the Russian language deteriorated, which affected women and their role in Azerbaijan, as they instead became the keepers and purveyors of Azeri cultural traditions. Zirka statistics demonstrate that today, more women than men speak Russian, which he explains by suggesting that Russian gives women an advantage in job opportunities, prestige, and cultural values. Azeri women choose to speak Russian as it is associated with less clear-cut traditional female roles. While Azeri men predominantly opt to speak Azeri, Azeri women choose to speak the language of their former colonizer to escape gender stereotypes and roles that would otherwise reduce them to keepers of culture. Zirka's argument helps us understand why Jafar's use of the Russian language is appropriate for her novel, since Jafar addresses a taboo subject matter in Azeri culture, sexual violence. Therefore, writing in Russian helps Jafar alienate from Azeri cultural taboos to describe Azeri women's experiences. Writing her novel in Russian allows Jafar to transcend Azeri traditional roles, including shame when discussing sexual assault. Jafar's focus on sexual violence during the Karabakh conflict addresses an under-acknowledged part of the war. The Karabakh conflict rose during Soviet rule, when Soviet police forces encouraged the Azeri-Armenian conflict, in quote-unquote. In the early 20th century, the Russian Empire saw rising revolutionary movements countrywide, and particularly in the South Caucasus. As Svante Kornel writes, nothing did more to mobilize Azerbaijan's population and spur the Azeri national movement than the issue of Mountainous Karabakh. For Azeris specifically, scholar Mehragis Nazafzadeh states that during the Karabakh War, quote, an estimated 20,000 Azeris were killed, 50,000 were wounded or injured, 5,000 are still missing, and 750,000 to 1 million Azeris were forced from their homes in Armenia and from their homes in Nagorno-Karabakh and the seven adjacent districts within Azerbaijan. Despite the brutality of the Karabakh conflict, Jafar's novel demonstrates an alternative, more peaceful outcome for the two nations. Jafar's rescue and adoption of an Armenian child shows the possibility of love between Armenian and Azeri nations, despite its seeming impossibility during the war. During her escape, Fahriye saves an Armenian newborn by convincing Nina Khala, whom we see here on the picture, an Azeri elderly female doctor escaping with Fahriye, to help the Armenian woman giving birth despite her ethnicity. Fahriye later thinks, after saving the boy, it's not his fault that war started, that on his birthday he was left alone, became a helpless orphan. Fahriye later adopts the Armenian boy, names him Amir, and treats him as her own son. Fahriye and Amir's relationship, her unconditional love for someone of the nation that brutally murdered her family, and Jafar's expression of this love in Russian, ironically reveals the Soviet Union's goal of unity amongst its subjects, even though this accomplishment comes in the context of its encouragement of the Karabakh War. Furthermore, Murad's name, meaning desired or wanted, reveals Jafar's argument that Azeri men should accept the events of the Karabakh War and the sexual violence women had to endure. His implicit acceptance of Amir and decision to marry Fahriye, even after she adopts her son, further shows the text's desire for Azeris and Armenians to love each other, not simply as neighbors, as with Anait's family, but in the way that Fahriye loves Amir, as a mother loves her child. The ending of the novel reveals this desire for reconciliation between Azeri men and women, and between Azerbaijan and Armenia. Jafar's focus on specifically gendered sexual violence during the Karabakh War sheds light on these horrific strategies used to subdue Azeris during the conflict. For example, upon her escape from the village, Fahriye visits her house and finds her entire family murdered. Fahriye describes Sudaba, her little handicapped sister, with a broken head in her grandmother's white shawl, clutching her bell. Sudaba's rape is later discovered when the Armenian soldiers tell Armen's family, "We fucked this bitch with the entire platoon while taking turns, and then broke her head, she's a cripple, couldn't close her legs, then she lay like a whore." This brutal description reveals not only the gendered violence that Armenians caused Azeri women, but also the colonial role in condoning or even fostering such tactics during the Karabakh War. As Korf writes, quote unquote, "During the pogroms, the Soviet police either did not react to the phone calls for help or responded that they were coming but never arrived. Although the Armenian soldiers directly caused violence to Azeri women, the Soviets' lack of action might be seen as a silent support of this gendered violence. As in other global conflicts, the Armenian soldiers' strategic use of rape functioned as a technique of ethnic cleansing and forced mobilization. As Jaspir Puar writes in her recent book, The Right to Maim, the Armenians did not simply kill all of Azeri women, but they raped and tortured them to maintain control of bodies and populations. Rape caused a liberal eugenics lifestyle that caused Azeris to clear out of the Karabakh territory so that the Armenians could remain there. Indeed, in her article, Rape as a Tool Against Women in War, Aziz Iskandarova explains that by raping Azeri women, Armenian soldiers forced Azeris to leave their lands, which helped the Armenian cause during the war. Iskandarova also notes that while Azeri men left to fight off the Armenian troops, the women and children left behind were often subjected to sexual violence by Armenian soldiers. Jafar's novel, in fact, falls within a broader tradition of Russophone literature that similarly offers testimony against sexual violence as a tool of war. For example, Svetlana Alexievich's book of oral history, The Unwomanly Face of War, written in Russian and published in 1985, collects hundreds of women's testimonies of their experiences during World War II. Each story tells of the atrocious experiences women had to endure, including rape, loss of their femininity, such as menstruation, and even killing their own children. Alexievich's book was heavily criticized and even redacted when it was first published because women told the emotional story of war rather than the heroic war narrative that audiences wanted to read and that the state wanted to support. However, Alexievich's work contributed an important type of history that challenged the patriarchal political states narrative of the heroic bravery of male soldiers by instead focusing on the difficult experiences of women that demonstrate the affective and physical atrocities of war. Consequently, Alexievich uses the female voice and women's experiences to problematize the Soviet propaganda that glorified World War II and militarized history. By writing within an already widely lauded tradition of Russophone testimonies of gendered violence during war, Jafar brings attention to the specifically Azeri experience during the Karabakh War. Similar to Alexievich's use of Russian, even though she herself is Belarusian, Jafar's choice of Russian to voice the atrocious crimes that Azeri women had to endure during the Karabakh War also allows her to reach a wider audience, not only in Azerbaijan, but in other post-Soviet countries. However, at the same time, Jafar's use of Russian also reveals how this colonial language implicitly constructs gender in the Soviet Union and independent Azerbaijan. Jafar's use of Russophone literature to critique gender in Azerbaijan demonstrates the sense in which the discourse of post-colonialism implicitly and by definition continues to rely on language, structure, and logic of colonialism. I recognize that the aforementioned leads to a deeper analysis between and distinction between testimony and history, and I do go into it in detail in my thesis, but for this presentation's sake, I didn't have enough time to go over it, but I'm more than happy to answer any questions after the presentation. Despite Fakhriya's fictitious nature, it helps understand from a literary perspective Azeri women's traumatic experiences during the Karabakh War and more broadly under the Soviet rule. Jafar's novel presents the paradox of colonial legacy. Although it seems like Azeri women achieved more freedom due to Russian colonialism, the oppression of the Soviet rule on Azeri people's freedom of thought and speech and its encouragement of the Karabakh conflict reveals the idea of Russian allowing Azeri women to progress as ultimately only a colonial trap. By writing her novel in the language of colonial power, Jafar exemplifies the Russian language's impact on discussion of gender in Azerbaijan. However, Jafar's use of Russian also suggests that the conversation about women's traumatic experiences during the Karabakh War must occur both within the Azeri community and amongst the broader Russophone literary community as well. Jafar's use of Russian acts as a reckoning both for Azeri men's complicity in oppression with the imposition of silence, as well as a condemnation for the broader colonial structures that led to the Karabakh conflict. It also models an opportunity for reconciliation, since the novel about the Karabakh War supports and defends the Azeri position while not explicitly vilifying the Armenians. With Murad's character, Jafar also leaves the door open for this conversation to take place in Azeri. In addition, the fact that a man, Javed Abbasov, translates Jafar's text reveals, as Murad's name indicates, a desire for a male Azeri leadership. Indeed, the two versions of the text, both Russian and Azeri, were published together so that one text does not seem significantly more authoritative than the other. It seems to circulate simultaneously, but for potentially different audiences. Consequently, Jafar problematizes her use of Russian and takes a first step in moving towards having the conversation of Soviet oppression and sexual assault during the Karabakh War in Azeri. Jafar uses the Azeri Russophone literary sphere as a space to problematize masculine and feminine gender roles, while also revealing the mutually constitutive relationship between gender, ethnicity, post-colonialism, and language in Azerbaijan. Thank you. Thank you. Okay, awesome. Dr. Farewell, I can't hear you.
That was excellent. Thank you. Do you want to field your own questions or do you want me to moderate?
Can you moderate, please?
Sure. So I will now take, people are chiming in with applause via the chat. Everyone should be unmuted now. So if you have a question, go ahead and jump in. Oh, Bob, Bob has a raised hand.
Thank you, Leia. You made a comment early on that intrigued me. Can you tell us more about what fictional representation can add to testimony and oral history?
Yeah, for sure. So in the thesis, the question that I ask is, what can fiction do that reality or testimony or history can't do? And history as a genre in and of itself, it has to, like as a subjective genre, has to back up everything that it's saying, has to back up every claim, but fiction, because it's already something that's made up and not real at its core, the author doesn't have to back it up with anything. So in Jafar's case, for example, it allows her to talk about these events without having to specifically give proof of what actually happened. And although, and I mean, that's problematic too, because there's not a lot of novels or texts, like fictional, non-fictional, on the Karabakh conflict in general. So we tend to look at these texts for, and we, you know, give these expectations that they're gonna fulfill the true history of what actually happened when it's a fiction. So for example, we can look at this text and yes, we're tempted to say that it is a testimony or like it's a true account of events, but because it's a fiction, it's a representation or it's a retelling of an event. And even if there is that true fictional event, so let's say a Sudaba, the little sister's rape, that is true within the fiction. But there are so many different layers within the text from the narrations that we are further filtered, and that truth is further filtered. So we have the Sudaba's rape, which is told by Fakhia, and then Sevinç, the narrator, tells of that story. Then we have the author who's telling us that story, and we have us, who, which adds to the fourth layer. And sometimes there's a fifth layer, for example, Minahala, she tells of another story and Fakhriya tells of that story. So it's just a building off of different levels. And although, yes, there's that fictional truth within the story of what actually happened, we have to keep in mind that it's made up and it's not true. But having said all of that, books like these, I mean, fictions like these that tell or that represent such historical events, they allow, for example, women to voice their appearance, voice their experiences, which wouldn't have been possible otherwise. So, what I argue is that yes, it's a way of representation, but we mustn't take it as true testimony or history because it still remains a fiction. If that makes sense.
Would you say that fictional representation can take us into the experience in a way that history can't?
You said that fictional...
fictional representation can take us into the experience.
Yeah.
In the way that history can.
Yeah, definitely. Because even, for example, comparing Alexievich's text that I mentioned earlier, her text is literally just testimonies after testimonies. There's no narrative. There's no plot. It's just one person's story after the other. And I found Jafar's text much more interesting and complex and just... I would say it's deeper to read because the genre, we're not so much focused on facts and it's the representation of the story that counts. So I find it can represent things much better than historical factual texts.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thanks.
Definitely, Chris.
I have a question.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, thank you very much, Leila, for a very interesting, first of all, thesis that I enjoyed reading as a second reader and also for your presentation. As I was reading your thesis again before your talk today, I wonder if you could comment a little bit about the setting of the novel. So the setting of the novel takes place in a hospital, right? This is where we hear the story of Fakhriya and this is where we experience what happened. How would you analyze the setting? How would you see it? Does it have a symbolic value in your opinion? Can it be linked to your idea of the healing process, for example? If you could comment on that.
Yeah, for sure. And I mean, we talked about this with, and I asked you about it as well, and we talked about it with Dr. Grewal. It seems very arbitrary that all the women are in a hospital and we only get an explanation for Sevinç, I believe, why she's in the hospital. We don't know why the other two women are there in the same space. At the same time, and she shares these traumatic events. And as I mentioned earlier, it's like this common readership or this audience, like these three women. So she's telling these stories to these three women, and they're kind of her witnesses, and it helps the healing as well. So there's like that figurative healing while she's telling these stories, and then there's that literal healing because they're in a hospital. So I just find that setting packed with the entire experience of what happened to Fakhriya in her life during the war, because she healed and in the hospital as well, literally and as well through storytelling.
Yeah. Thank you.
Any other questions? Yeah, David Grant. Yeah.
Hi, Layla. I enjoyed your presentation.
Thank you.
And I was wondering whether your presentation is linked to, I believe you're going to go to a conference in March, which I presume was canceled.
Canceled, tragically, yes.
Unfortunately.
were you going to present this particular work there or something related to this work?
It was something related to this work in a strange way. When we actually started thinking about this thesis, we were going to do another author. Also another Azeri author, but focusing more on the linguistic level of things, so how translation works and how meaning is lost or gained in translation. He is mentioned here in the thesis. I didn't talk about him in the presentation just for time's sake, but it was on the same subject of linguistic differences, so it was less related than those. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, Marlon? You're muted.
There we go. Okay. Actually, Layla, you queued me up for my question, which is you talked really interestingly, and thank you for this whole presentation. It's fascinating. You spoke really interestingly about the use of Russian and the choice of Russian to write this book. And I was curious, is there any sense of what language the women speak amongst themselves in the hospital? Are they speaking in Russian? Are they speaking in Azeri? Do you know? Is it translated in the text?
Yeah, really good question. They're speaking Russian.
Okay.
And the only thing is they mention in Azeri sometimes, there was this one instance when one of the women was feeling sad and they asked her to sing this traditional song. So the title of the song was in Azeri, but their conversation with themselves and even when their family comes, it's still in Russian.
Really interesting. Thank you.
I have a question. Hi, Leila. Thanks. That was really great. I've kind of a follow-up to the question about using Russian. Mm-hmm. I was wondering, like, are you suggesting that, I think you're saying that this is clearly the author's decision to use Russian was a very deliberate choice on her part. Mm-hmm. I'm wondering, is this something that applies to other Azeri women writers or writers in general, and perhaps mm-hmm. even other writers from other former Soviet republics?
Yeah, for sure. Very good question. The other writer, Ibrahim Beyev, that I mentioned, but I didn't talk about him in here, he was writing during the Soviet period. So he was writing in Russian because that was the language of the masses. So if you wanted to get your work out and if you wanted it to be widely read and accepted, you would have to have Russian rather than in Azeri because everybody was speaking Russian at that point, all of Soviet Union. And even until this day, women Russians and women writers and male writers, they choose to write in Russian. One of the big reasons is because of the readership. There's a lot more people who know Russian than Azeri because of the Soviet, you know, the colonization. So it was a deliberate choice for one reason, because it was a taboo subject, so it's easier to talk about it in Russian because you're not bound to the cultural tradition in this particular case, but in other cases, it's mostly for a wider readership so that more people have access to the text.
Right, but I think you're also saying that it's something, a specific choice for a woman writer yes. to Russian.
Yeah, because once again, it's more what she's writing about will be less criticized and is more accepted if it is in Russian because it doesn't tie to Azeri culture. So it allows her more freedom, I guess, in the subject matter that she can write in.
Very cool. Thank you.
Yeah.
Any other questions?
Yeah. Dr. Dad.
Thank you very much. I'm not surprised. I'm very impressed. And I think I can speak for everyone when I say that. So what I was wondering about, I mean, the situation you describe is one of tremendous violence, and I think not necessarily unique, but it's distinct from things that go before it. But in the Caucasus, in the frontier zone between the cultures and religions on either side, intermarriage and taking captives, in which there's an element of violence, of course, is one of the few cultural interfaces. And I wonder if there's any sense in the novel of this deep background, deep historical background to this this situation.
Yeah. Interestingly enough, in this novel, it does not talk about specifically about intermarriage and the violence that comes with it. We just get the stories of, for example, Sudaba, who was raped by Armenian soldiers, and then Minahala, she tells another story of a rape that she saw. But interestingly enough, the example that we do get of a marriage is with Murad and Fakhriya. And the marriage between them is, for Murad, it's very much against the Azeri traditional male roles, because he accepts what happened to her and he accepts the fact that she adopted an Armenian child, which it was, you know, it's unthinkable. So the novel doesn't necessarily mention that specific violence. It shows kind of this different side of it, which gives it more hope, I guess, or models what kind of marriage or relationship between people should have been during that time, but it doesn't mention the specific intermarital violence.
So just a narrative question.
Yes.
Murat knows that Amir is Armenian.
Yes.
Okay. Yeah.
Okay. And there was the scene in the book when she adopted, and when Fakhriya adopted him, she lived with Minahala, so three of them lived together. And Murad came and he asked for her hand, and Minahala said, "You guys need to talk about this stuff, and he needs to know." And when she told him, she thought that he was going to run away and just, you know, just leave her. But he accepted him and her, and yeah.
Thank you.
Dr. Brisbane, you had a question.
Yeah, so we, you know, speaking about the language and then also this historical context of violence and memory, you see the literature, but also the nonfiction perhaps playing into a distinction between sort of social versus cultural memory or social versus cultural linguistic practices?
Yes. Sorry, I'm just trying to figure this out. So you're asking, like, is there the difference between the two, or the two mentioned in the novel?
Well, how they play out in your theorization or methodology of the work? Because on the one hand, there's sort of the cultural practice of adopting Russian language.
Right.
But at the same time, representing the social Russian function of military soldiers committing atrocities and war crimes. So there's sort of a use of Russian to expose Russian social abuse.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so, whereas in your argument rejecting Azeri language over Russian languages allows them to in turn, you know, represent Azeri society in different ways or maneuver through that society. So that distinction between culture and society is interesting, and I wonder if you'd expand on that a little bit.
Yeah, for sure, and it's ironic in its sense as well, because Jafar, she chooses to represent this cultural and social violence in the language in which it was committed, if that makes sense. Which is, ironic in and of itself, because she can't express it in Azeri because it won't be as accepted. So yes, she's describing the, on a social level, all of the atrocities that were committed during war in Russian, and on a cultural level as well. Like just the conversations between the woman and the hospital, and the fact that she's writing herself in Russian. So I would say that would be a relationship between the two, or ironic relationship between the two.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Going once, going twice. Okay, please join me in thanking Leila for her excellent presentation.
Thank you.
And thank you all for your attendance today. Leila, I will be in touch with you right after.
Okay. Okay. Perfect. Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye.
Well done, Leila.
Thank you.
Well done.